Das Gespräch geht jetzt weiter, und zwar kommt zuerst Avery Gordon dazu, und die Diskussion wird auch mit Erno Frohn bis zum Schluss auch fortgesetzt, und dann klärt sich auch, denke ich, der Zusammenhang mit der Utopia Station. Broadcast here in Frankfurt. So, what are you doing in sociology in Chicago? No.
Normally I am in California. That's California. Where I work. I mean,
because we are more Chicago school here in Frankfurt.
I'm in Paris this year.
Yeah.
On sabbatical doing research.
Yeah.
Writing a book about utopian consciousness, which is, I think, why I'm here at the Utopian Station with these folks.
Yeah.
To talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Okay, so... Utopia consciousness, what's really... This is a new microphone. Now Hans-Ulrich Obst passed by. And because we talked now on this Auschwitz process exhibition here in Frankfurt, and my question to Erno Frohn was, is there a connection between this kind of between Utopia Station and how to work after 68 and after these kind of eruptions, after the process, Auschwitz process here in Frankfurt? How is it possible now to talk on Utopia consciousness in relation to Utopia Station? What do you think has this to do with art concepts, to talk after this kind of modernity changed after Auschwitz a lot, as we cannot really say something on paradigm? The question is, how would you mention art in this context?
I think you should talk to Hans Ulrich more directly. You should answer the question about the Utopia Station itself, because I'm a guest, really, of the Utopia Station. But the question that you have asked about the concept of utopia, that I can speak to that a little bit. One of the things that I've been working on and writing about is less about utopia as a place, a no place, the good nowhere, the future place that we have this idea of it in mostly in the West, but really trying to redefine the meaning of the term when we look at a whole set of different kinds of political activities and political consciousness. For example, the anti-slavery movement that started many, many centuries ago, but that continues today in different ways. There are a set of, in fact, the most important in many ways, radical social movements and profound social movements have never been taken to be examples of utopian consciousness or utopian practice. We think of utopia as either a literary phenomenon or something that's really imaginary.
Yeah.
But the people who make social change are in many ways utopians. That is to say that they believe and act for the better world that they want in the present.
Yeah.
And so that's the work that I've been doing. And this 1968 is not that important, really, quite frankly. It's one date among many. You could ask the question
because we had this
about
talk
after 1769.
I mean, Stein yesterday, and he was saying that 68 was really that it showed the limits of state power. But if you think in Germany on why was it a problem to have these limits? We had these limits because of nationalism, national socialism, also Nationalsozialismus. Right. And the question is really utopian consciousness and becoming a new. Karl Mannheim was someone who wrote books in 1930, like Ideologie and Utopie, who always was important to know what's so new.
Right. I mean, I don't agree with Emanuel Wallerstein with his historical schema that he presented yesterday, because I think that 1968 is important, but it's not particularly that important from other parts of the world, from other groups of people. It's not the most important thing. But there are all kinds of fascism. I mean, the whole point of being a utopian is that you're going to believe that that fascism or authoritarianism is not inevitable. It is not the way it has to be.
Yeah.
And this notion is very ancient.
Yeah.
It's very old, and it will have a future.
Yeah.
And so things change that make us have different kinds of political movements. But that general impulse, I think, is very old.
And you, as a sociologist, do have a special perspective on how curators try to make something new?
Creators or curators?
Curators. Curators or creators? If they work on utopia.
I think that curators... well, Daniel Birnbaum was just talking about the passive curator who says yes and doesn't say no, but who is a facilitator for projects. I mean, curators are like, in a way, they're like teachers and they're like organizers. They help to make things happen. I don't know, Hans Org, this is, you're a curator, I'm not a curator.
I actually have to go back in a few seconds back to the space, as we are the organizers of this event.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to introduce Anton Vidocle, who arrived, one of the participating artists, and to answer maybe very briefly to this question about the curating. I very much agree with Daniel Birnbaum. I've always used this idea of the curator as a catalyst or a facilitator or a trigger, and obviously a catalyst has to be able to disappear, and it's just, you know, a catalyst of processes. And I think one thing which is very important is that we haven't spoken about very much so far in the Utopia Station conference here, actually, in Frankfurt. It's this link to urbanism. I mean, a lot of this is very much inspired by practices of urbanists such as Jonah Friedman or Cedric Price, who in the sort of early 60s started to question this idea of the master plan and started to say that we should look, I mean, if you look at cities and at planning, we should start to look at notions of self-organization, we should look at notions of auto-organization and so on. And in a strange way, these ideas have never really been entered in a certain way the curatorial discussion, which until quite recently has very much been a discussion of about control, about a list of artists which is drafted, about an exhibition draft which is done and then somehow executed. And we thought with exhibitions like Utopia Station or Cities on the Move or Laboratorium that it can be very interesting to sort of take these models, Cedric Price, the non-plan, self-organization, and Jonah Friedman, his idea of sort of many autonomous elements which are linked through bridges in a way. It's like cells, autonomous cells where you actually create bridges and pedestrian bridges, as one could say, as Félix Fénéon used to say. It's another kind of definition of curating, to sort of, you know, make pedestrian bridges also for the different, you know, audiences. And I think one of the things which is interesting in all these urbanistic models, in a certain way, of Cedric Price or Jonah Friedman, is to which extent they resonate now. And that was obviously, I mean, I think one of the most important point of discussion of these 2 days here in Frankfurt, through Avery's presence, through Emanuel Wallerstein's presence, through the presence of artists and photographers who all visited the World Social Forum in Mumbai and previously in Porto Alegre, has been this idea to which extent there is a really interesting parallel structure going on between Utopia Station with with all these sort of temporary autonomous zones to use this town of Hakim Bay, and in a certain way a similar thing happening in Porto Alegre, Mumbai. And that's why here, I mean, I would say one of the central discussions was our plan now as a next step to actually go with Utopia Station to Porto Alegre next year. And that's one of the many links somehow to Avery and her work, which has very been focused on World Social Forum, the activity Avery had in the first Porto Alegre events. But now I would like to actually lead this to Anton Vidocle, who has been very interested in notions of self-organization, urbanism, and just on this wonderful project in Mexico.
One question: Why is there a necessary for it that art or utopia stations have to be connected to new social movements? Is there a need that art, like you work on with the utopia station in Venice and so on, that there's a link between the new social movements and art? Must there a connection? Is there a need for it, or... Why?
Yes, I mean,
is there a reason for it?
We don't start really from an a priori. It's all to do with conversations, and these conversations always start with conversations with artists, and decidedly throughout the generation, if it's Leon Golub and Nancy Spiro, whom we mentioned before, who've actually introduced us to Avery Gordon's work, and they are actually, Leon Golub is illustrating the new book of Avery. Maybe we can talk about this a little bit later. Through to a much younger generation of artists, this project is always based on an infinite conversation with artists.
Okay.
And out of this conversation grew this sort of desire and necessity to redefine a sort of social contract of the arts now, and that led to this project where actually Utopia, it's not a theme show about Utopia on Utopia. Utopia in this sense is more
it's a trigger,
it's an engine.
It's a conversation, yeah.
And,
okay.
Yes, I'd like to introduce Anton Vidocle, who will tell us about his very exciting project.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Yes, but also to answer your question a little bit more, it's, you know, things do not exist in a vacuum. I mean, it's not really possible to maintain some kind of an autonomous area for art practice. Should I sit here?
Yeah, because I...
You know, outside of events that unfold in the world, outside of new social movements. So, you know, while it's not a necessity, it's a condition, you know. Yes.
And you ask, how would you describe this kind of condition? Maybe.
Well, it's not a new condition. It's a constant condition that art does not evolve, or art does not develop its ideas outside of a larger social sphere, you know, and a larger field of involvement, which, and a part of it is Mumbai, part of it, perhaps.
I mean, another way to say it, I think, is just that the artist, like the sociologist, the secretary, I mean, any person has always to confront the world around them.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so you're always facing a moral choice about how you confront that world. For some of us, it's more direct in our actual work, whether, in my case, you're teaching and writing, or you should say more about some of the projects that you're actually doing, very different than the old utopian architecture of the priestly city on the hill, right? Very different. But we all face this choice. And so in that sense, you know, you decide, where am I sending my children to school? Where am I not? What are they reading? Is that okay? Is that history a history that I'm going to accept that they learn? Do I teach them something different? Do I vote for this person, that person? I mean, all these questions about, in some sense, the moral choices of the society around us, everyone has to face them. And so artists, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, life is a kind of a permanent interdisciplinary condition where you're basically a one-man band that, you know, have to deal with all aspects of life, you know.
Maybe.
I'll just remember to forget to laugh a little like you, smile a little like you. get to do, I'll just remember to forget you. Just remember to forget you. I'll just remember to forget.
It's not, you don't see people watching or experiencing anything. You
right,
see,
that goes on exactly.
But there's a sense in which you can imagine yourself just kind of standing out there and going with the flow of that sense of time and change. Yeah. And I think that as someone who comes out, I mean, I come from a long history of doing political activism and being social science and, you know, all of that, okay, so...
And you worked on radicalism.
You know, it's like I have a lot of time in meetings and people who want the facts and the real issues, and we have to get down to brass tacks and all of this. And there's, I think, a way in which it's the process by which individuals change and come to find ways of living that are better are not like that. We're not rationalistic creatures like that. And so our engagement with these artistic processes, whether we're making them or watching them or participating in some way in that way, is good for us politically. It frees us to some other way. That's good. That doesn't change, you know, the thing that you've got to vote at some point and you've got to build the roads and all of that.
Yeah, that's exactly in that way that also the installation of Tanya Bruguera functions inside of the show. This installation is Responsibility for Fate. It's the title. And she works with those two items, for responsibility and fate. And people get the possibility to think about these items to her installation, which naturally is individually completely different by one to the other, but it's simply giving the opportunity to interact on these items in a very specific way. That's what she's doing, and she uses documentary material to realize this. So the documentary material gives this freedom to act and to have another approach to such kind of items like responsibility and fate. You see, that's in that way that what you were explaining, which I thought was very exactly that.
Yeah, I mean, I've written about this idea of fate because I'm very interested in, to some extent, the agency of people to be, in effect, divine, you know, to assume the right of divinity and not to be always the objects of some greater superior power's making. That's, to me, what it means to be a utopian.
Yeah.
That you are actually the creators of the world, not that it belongs to someone else to do that, which is very much, I think, related to ideas of fate and also faith, perhaps, in a certain way. But I will give up my seat.
But no, one moment, because I think this should be interesting. I was thinking on having contrasts in inviting Erno Frohn and Utopia Station, because they're really some a kind of negative utopian perspective because of this kind of Auschwitz people, really.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
Which is that the only reason you need a utopian standpoint is because things are horrible and terrible and despicable and cruel.
And that's why I think Rax is really interesting because of their work with asylum seekers, and they call it warehouse. And that's maybe interesting for you if Shuda should explain it in a short... much it needs, because of this work with we heard from Anton. This should be a good contrast.
I feel like an interloper in a conversation that's been going on.
No, so it's not wrong.
But it's interesting to connect the ideas of a utopia of some other place to the core of what we are trying to work with and grapple with in the warehouse project, where we're basically trying to invite those who've been made illegal or rendered illegal by state structures, initially in Europe, and possibly the project will expand elsewhere, to construct memories of the places that they have left behind, which are in some senses unreachable places, because if you're a political exile, you have a very good reason to leave, and you probably have reasons not to be able to go back. So it's in a sense, in some senses, it's the mirror of utopia. It's what one leaves behind, rather than what one goes towards. And I think that for me personally, the idea of utopia, and it's interesting to connect it to the notions of faith that you were talking about, is interesting only if it's like a persistent reminder, something that you look at every day. I am quite taken by the idea that for a materialist like myself, a philosophical materialist, someone committed to a materialist position in philosophy, I still find it necessary to inaugurate each day a question that sometimes gets asked better within concerns that are properly called spiritual. I think they're always answered unsatisfactorily in that context, but they get asked. And I want to ask, I want to know how I can, as a materialist, ask a question about the relationship. It's almost an eschatological question. It's almost a question about what is the end of the time of one's life. What is the end in the sense, not as a termination, but purpose. Purpose and termination in that sense. Why continue? Why do you wake up in the morning? Why do you do things? And and we've been playing around, Monica and I, in Rux, Monica Jibesh and I, with this idea of utopias as being lands of milk and honey, which is why we spoke yesterday in the text about somewhere you go to procure provisions for living. And if you do not have that notion of provisions for living, of things that make living worthwhile or necessary, then you don't really have a reason to get up in the morning. Mm-hmm. You don't really have a reason to awaken yourself from any kind of sleep. And that's why for me, there is some... I'm a person who can never pray because I have nothing to pray to. Mm-hmm. But I think a daily reminder of why continue without an answer is sometimes a necessity. And when I connect that back to the warehouse project, those who take the risk to leave their lives, the material structure of their lives, are taking a radical decision to continue, because despite circumstances being such that they cannot continue, so they have to locate elsewhere in order to continue, in order to be who they are. For me, it's a very simple reason. If you're an Iranian exile in Frankfurt, one of the reasons why you are who you are, if you're a woman, is because you don't want to cover your head. That's an important reason. It may be a very small reason, but it's an important reason. If you have to go back to Iran, under present circumstances, you would have to cover your head. It's possible that there will be exiles in Germany from France who come precisely for the reason that they want to cover their heads, which is the opposite reason. Yeah. But still, the reasons in and of themselves are not as important as the fact that they're important to the people who believe in them.
I mean, in some ways, faith, you don't need to pray to anyone. Faith is just that continuity without certainty. Yeah. I mean, I was talking earlier today about utopianism being about being unable, refusing to be subject to servitude, being or becoming unavailable for servitude. And Molly had said, I heard you say certitude. And I said, these are not the same, which I don't think they are, but I do think that the continuity without certitude, which is all we don't have it, of course, that's all faith is. You all have a wonderful formulation that I really like, which is that utopia is a hearing aid, which I like because I think of the utopian as opposed to the place as a kind of standpoint for living in now. We don't ever live in the future, we only live now. And this notion that it's, the manifesto or the piece you read yesterday was very beautiful about listening, and since we're on the radio too, about the hermeneutics of listening and utopia as a hearing aid. This is their idea. It's very nice, I think.
Hey. Yeah, the question is this philosophical notion we have since the antique philosophy on the question what is a good life, and this is always connected to this kind of utopia as in this kind of thinking on the good or better life. And the question is really, is this the hope you will give, maybe, or will you give? And this would be the connection to the freedom of art. Is there kind of hopes that you can give if you work together here with asylum seekers and their remembrance and the kind of memory on the abandoned?
My views in art are on the role of art are always cautionary towards modesty. I mean, we had a discussion about this earlier. That's because I'm very. When people, for instance, call us artists, I always look over my shoulder. I think they're always talking about someone else. But yeah. I take art very seriously. Yeah. I mean, the field of art is I think extremely exciting in the sense that it allows people like us. I mean, I would say that what you're doing in radio, what you're doing today, is our practice. And why should it not be considered art practice? Are you artists? I would hesitate because I share a solidarity about with you, and it's I think a solidarity of hesitation. But what we do when we create meaning, when we create affects, is I think extremely important. If the warehouse project is able to raise a few questions in people's minds about the necessity of an ethic of hospitality, about how does one receive the presence of others, I think it will have gone a fair way. It's not designed to do more than that.
Yeah, okay.
That's a lot, yeah. I would like to interact on that, because also in this project of the Auschwitz process, we have this young Belgian artist, Els Dietfors, who has an association in Brussels, which also is an association that deals with fugitive people that are coming from other countries without anything, and she creates within this association like casting, theater, film, so to give these people a sense of their own future, of a possible utopia. So her association is in fact a transmitter of a utopian way of seeing the future for such kind of people who left everything behind, come without anything to this this Brussels, to the Belgian capital city. And she works with this association already for 6 years and is really doing wonderful jobs. And she will present within this Auschwitz process exhibition her newest film on some prisoners, youngster prisoners in Belgium who are talking about guilt and not being guilty and guilt. So to transport within the future, also when you have this historical context, but to transport a certain future for the people who visit the show. Such kind of things are very important. It's not only about this historical event, but it's also certain items within this historical event put into a possible future, and see what art is doing with this as transporters, as mediators, as a little bit this, but this it's a little bit in the way that you are talking.
I think that that's extremely interesting, because I think that only by looking at the condition of the prisoner can those of us who are outside prisoners examine ourselves. Sure. Only by looking at the person without papers can we begin to understand what having papers means, not as an enabling thing necessarily, but also how having papers restricts us, restricts our view of how we construct the world.
Yeah.
I mean, there is, not to romanticize it, but there is also a freedom of the exile. Mm-hmm. There is the freedom, there is the act that a person has taken, has a step that a person has taken to refuse to live under certain conditions. Yeah. You see, the choice for an exile, and I think this is very important for people to understand in Europe, the choice for an exile is suicide or exile. If you feel that your life is impossible to live under these conditions anymore, you can either refuse to be who you are, which is, even if you continue living, it's like a form of suicide. I think you refuse to be the person you want to be, or you take steps to move.
Well, it's certainly a form of what a man named Orlando Patterson called social death.
Yeah, social death. Yeah. Exactly.
And the real I think issue of concern for people today is the extent to which people who are already potentially suffering from social death, either in their home countries or, for example, in the United States, in their own communities, in the civil society that they live in, who then enter into or are taken into prison, where they suffer then, in a way, doubly from that. I mean, social death was a concept that he used to describe the condition of the slave and the social negation, not of the person in and of themselves, because they, of course, retained, they were people, but the way in which the society treated the person as if they were dead, but they are nonetheless living. You see, so when you begin to treat living, breathing human beings, who are quite taxed, you know, whether it's the exile or the refugee, and then you treat them as if they are dead. Yeah. This is a terrible form of social violence.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question is also for a city like Frankfurt, and I think that it's important to ask this question. City of 700,000 people, 10,000 deportations occur every year from Frankfurt Airport. It is important for people in Frankfurt to consider for themselves whether they are prepared to continue living in a society in which 10,000 deportations occur every year. I'm asking the question the other way around. It's not only we recognize the fact that an Iranian or an Afghan or an Indian or an Iraqi or whatever who has to leave their homes and come here has made a decision that they cannot continue to live in those societies in as much as those societies continue to do certain things. People must ask the same question. The presence of the refugee or the exile in a city like Frankfurt must make the citizen of Frankfurt ask the same question about themselves.
Yeah, maybe there's really a need for a kind of new political discourse in relation to what will going on when the Auschwitz process exhibition will open, because they had millions of deportations, not 10,000.
I mean, it's a very good context for, as you said, raising the legacies, the contemporary issues that emerge also around the question of deportation, imprisonment, forced labor. I mean, many migrants are essentially in the condition of forced labor. I mean, you know, they're not just, they can't live for quote-unquote political reasons in the narrow sense, but most of the world's migrancy now is about following circuits of, in many ways, impossible labor. And that's
now after
work camps is what
60 years that Auschwitz ended, we have this kind of deportations situation which we accept now because we don't know it really or we don't want to recognize it as we
it's put behind certain curtains where people, because they're living very much in a certain form, in a material form, and they only function within this what you call material wellness, and they don't want to see certain, or don't want even to maybe hear certain things or read certain things. It's more or less the what you allow yourself, and maybe that's also because that's why I really think this exhibition is important, because a lot of people say I would not like to go to this exhibition. They are still like avoiding this item to go there, and having a bridge towards a certain possible discussion within the press presence and also within the future, I think if people can start seeing this within the context of the artworks that are presented and installations that are presented in the show, which maybe give them the opportunity to think further beyond their fears to go to pass this form materialistic and the form of avoiding. I think that could be very important for this society, because we still have within, I think, what I notice in Germany is certain kind of avoiding of certain problems. There is, I don't know how this is in other countries, but
I don't know, but
I think it's the same.
I think I know, yes.
I come from a country
What we experience...
Denial is the major national culture.
No, it's in every culture.
It's in every culture. Yeah.
What I wanted, would like to know, this was what Hans-Ulrich Oppes said, that conversation matters in a way for this kind of... indefinite talk with artists. This could be a really interesting connection, because what you said when we went to an asylum seeker apartment, where people you were talking on that this kind of conversation has to be started, has to be coming up.
Yeah, I mean, I think of the work of artists or anyone is people working with images and texts, you know. Let's look at the circulation of images in society. Let's take a simple thing like an identity card or a passport, which is an object that carries within it an image or data. It carries within it an image of a person and the life of a person. So it's, in a sense, a story, an image, a portrait, which is, you know, what literature and art is all about. I mean, you could say that the passport or an identity card is a work of art that is produced by agencies that govern the existence of millions of people. And if you look at the history of the passport, it's something that I've been quite preoccupied with. I mean, of course, there's Brecht's very beautiful and ironic statement in the Flüchtlingsgespräche, which says that it takes a lot more to produce a passport than it does to produce a human being. And, you know, I know this, you know, it is much more difficult to establish your worth as a citizenship than for a man and a woman to come together to create a child, for a child to be born. So birth and citizenship. Birth is easy, citizenship is difficult.
Yeah, and if you read Peter Weiss' Die Ermittlung, it's on the process, then you can really understand how easy it was, how the SS organized to kill people.
Yeah. But, I mean, what I wanted to say is that the current form of the passport, you know, its current aesthetic, that the particular size and shape of the portrait that it must carry of a person, because these are very strictly, you know, there has to be a certain distance, there has to be a certain color. It can't just be any picture of a person, you know. And early passports are very interesting to look at, because people just put any picture of themselves, and authorities said, no, these pictures won't do. And the production of the earliest passports, were of the passport photograph, is something that actually was created due to the result of the huge production of refugees after the First World War. So you needed mechanisms of identification. Today, what we take for granted as the badge of citizenship was actually created first to govern refugees.
Well, in the pre-modern passport, which didn't have photographs, pre-photographs, but they had something else, which was the seal and words of introduction and approval from the king. And that's essentially, they were the pre-modern passports were documents of introduction and verification for people moving between war zones, requiring the, if you like, the passport from the king. And that legacy is very much in the modern passport too, that the sovereign authorizes you as an agent with their approval to move within and beyond the walls of the kingdom. And so now they have this, you know, these more, they have the aesthetic that you're talking about, but they were vouchsafe documents initially, I mean, they come directly from the right of the sovereign to determine who can move within borders.
Yeah. Maybe in India it's really problematic to get passports now.
I think it'll be, I mean, if after 9/11 it's not going to be easy for anyone to get passports anywhere, to be honest. You know, I mean, you will, and this is not true of India, it's as true of the United States. The credibility of citizenship has to be established through information about who you are as a person. And the funny thing is, like, citizenship is something like a credit history. If you have nothing going against you, that's also ground for suspicion. It's like if you have no credit, if you've never taken a loan,
spent any money. Okay.
If you've never taken a loan, you will not get credit. So you have to have a relationship with the law, and you have a relationship with the law if you do something wrong. So people who have no traffic fines, for instance, are just as suspicious of people who have too many traffic fines.
Yeah.
So citizenship is a fine piece of work.
I mean, it's an interesting question if you think about the Palestinians, for example. I mean, people who really in many ways are stateless. The question of how a Palestinian travels is an interesting one. With what documents are they able to travel?
Yeah.
And in what places are not. I mean, we haven't talked about the practicalities of any of this, about going, for example, to Porto Alegre in Brazil, but the government of Brazil 2 years ago established what they called a policy of reciprocity, and it was initially directed towards the United States, because the United States requires of Brazilians interested in entering the United States a visa. That has to be applied for in person at the variety of U.S. embassies or consulates, and it charges a very expensive fee, the United States, $100 to get a visa. And so the government of Brazil said, we will establish a policy of reciprocity, and therefore they began a new policy requiring of any U.S. citizens a visa that had to be applied for in person at the two Brazilian consulates in the United States. There are only two of them, one in New York, one in Los Angeles. So it's a laborious process, and they charged $100 for it. And when you go to apply for your Brazilian visa, you must leave your passport with the Brazilian consulate. They don't give you the visa then. You have to leave it with your money and your photographs and everything else, and then they send it to you, or you can go back and get it depending on how far you are. I think is an interesting action on the part of a nation towards another nation, but it also, there's something also slightly, there was something, for example, when I went to apply for my visa, there was something slightly absurd in the whole process. There were a bunch of us, and we had gone to get our visas to go to the World Social Forum, and they know exactly why you want to go, and they're asking you, and you tell them, and they think it's really good that you're going. They put you through the paces of this anyway, and you say, okay, I understand this. And it's okay, but it nonetheless, at some point, it's this is not an answer, this reciprocity, to the larger problems around mobility and citizenship and placement in the world today. And I think that these are very complicated questions that I would like to see people start to talk about more concretely in the future, about how we are really imagining the nature of governance in a context in which we have very good reason to both need nation states and the protections that they continue to offer, but also they are not sufficient forms. There's not one of them I can think of that's democratic, and so they are not sufficient, and for many people in the world, they just don't function. So I think that this is a subject for which there is considerable work that a lot of people from lots of different
you know, different forms of the kind of research that they do need to begin to think about that, I think. Like, what will, if you imagine, do you imagine that we will need a passport in 20 years? If so, what would it look like?
Mm. Good question. Yeah. Maybe we should make a short break if... I can see there is Sir Edwin Evans. Hello. Would you like to pass by?
My chair.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's very nice to
this ghostly matters. What do you mean by ghostly matters?
It's a book about it's a book about social violence and the haunting effects that it produces. It's about thinking about power as the meeting of force and sort of individual meaning, about how to understand large-scale systems of power and the way they create sort of ghosts. That's what the book is about. It's a short one.
Okay. Would you like to sit and explain?
Thank you.
Yeah, that's cool.
Thank you. So, can I?
Yeah.
Can I exit?
Yeah.
And voice. Having said my voice, can I exit?
Yeah, you said you were.
Thank you very much, Felicia.
Is there phone is there from Munich, from Holstein?
Thank you.
Cigarette. Mr. Cigarette. Would you like to bring him to the here? Because I cannot get out. So, Sir Edwin Evans, I saw only a little part of your film. Can you explain what's for you the context of being part in Utopia Station as an artist?
Well, really, it's it's partly intention, partly desire, and partly coincidence, actually, to be here. But I think this is one of the great ways in which this forum functions. It should ideally then at least be loose and flexible, because I think Utopia must be flexible at all costs in order to embrace the arena of contradictions where desire and reality live. So somewhere, some kind of negotiation in between these two notions is, I think, where I'm very interested in taking this little space that I'm very fortunate to be provided by a group of people who have been generous and attentive enough to listen. So, I think we're in a very privileged position, and I think it's... I feel a little responsible for recognizing and appreciating that, actually. I mean, the conversations that were happening earlier about immigration, migration, identity, it's a great expense and value that we are able to have these conversations about things that are so important. So I think as artists, as thinkers, as readers, as cultural producers, we have to a certain extent some kind of obligation to value that space, to encourage that space. And this is, I think, where Utopia Station is at its most productive.
Yeah. And Hans-Ulrich Opes said the conversation matters in the way he's talking to artists. And what do you say? How are curators really talking and having conversations with artists? What is really special with it?
Well, you know, there's a history of the way in which people have wanted to reinvent this kind of notion of being the curator. And we've gone through on the talk, the very interesting talk that Daniel Birnbaum gave this evening about somehow...
Say yes and not no.
Yes. And somehow to have somehow then the notion of just enabling an artist to enter within this kind of social matrix and change the rules a little bit is different from saying we want this painting and that painting, we only want the work from 1929 and not the one from 1931 because it's not as good, etc. changes. So the rules have changed a little bit, and that's and many people have, I suppose, tried to reinvent that and look at that again. So this kind of return to, I'm a little nervous about the kind of positivistic humanism which invades notions of the utopic as a kind of revisiting of a kind of radical chic from a certain moment. I'm a little suspicious of that. You find that filtering through into pop occultural forms in many, many different ways, and this kind of postmodern notion of revisiting the kind of radical space is, I think, one we should be a little bit suspicious of. But then at the same time, I think of, you know, Georges Bataille and John Cage. Or Cage is, you know, how to make the world a better place. You will only make matters worse.
Yeah.
That's also something maybe to come also back to the exhibition, because Fritz Bauer, who is the
exhibition on Auschwitz.
On the Auschwitz trial.
Trial,
and the one who was let's say, initiating this process was Fritz Bauer, the attorney in law. And he naturally also had this kind of utopia about that Germany would see through this process their own past in another way and could, let's say, not in another way, but could think about what happened before in another and different way. So he had an utopistic vision on what he wanted the society to become. Naturally, this utopia gave him the force to make this process happening, because he really wanted something to change inside of the society. And I think that's important. At the end, he saw also that he could maybe not have reached everything that he was visualizing, and he was also a little bit in that field, let's say, confronted with reality. But the motor was maybe also an utopian vision, but the reality that comes afterwards should also be considered as a very important point. If you have an utopia, you have also a reality behind this utopia or created by the utopia.
Absolutely, yes. I think in as much it would be great to be complete in and of oneself, narcissism is ultimately a kind of cul-de-sac. No, I think transitivity between bodies is what we're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You worked together with Derek Sharman.
I did many years ago, yes. Derek was an enormously influential person in my life, very, very generous. When I was an art student in London, I moved from rural Wales to London in 1976, so many years ago now.
Yes.
And somehow there was a kind of revolution happening in my life. So right into the center of the West End of London. And I think the second day that I got there, I met Sid Vicious and the Sex Pistols in the pub next door. So this was like coming in on a very high level, actually. No, this was very exciting. And Derek lived over the road. He had an apartment, Phoenix House, on Charing Cross Road. And we met in a cake shop around the corner, a French patisserie called Patisserie Valerie. And for some reason, maybe he was a little bit hungover, he couldn't remember the name of Louise Brooks. And he said, "What's the name of this actress who took part in Pandora's Box?" And I recognized who he was, but I couldn't help myself from just replying to his question. And so that was the answer, and so that's how we met. It was over Pandora's Box and Louise Brooks.
Okay, and his last film, the blue one, it's on the transitivity, I think.
I suppose it is. Yes, we never really saw eye to eye in terms of the kind of work that he made, and I worked with him quite a long time. He's incredibly generous, very supportive, but it's a different thing. Derek wanted other things
than I wanted, in a sense. We never had a physical relationship in any way, but we had an incredibly intimate relationship over the kind of way in which we would share out work. And that was really something, because he'd say, okay, dear, now you're going to edit this one, or you're going to film the next one, or you're going to do the sound on the next one. So it was really a pretty great education, actually. So he was wonderful. I wasn't so close to him by the time he died, because I was absolutely terrified of the fact that he would actually leave. And I wasn't strong enough at the time in order to kind of be there for him. But that's how it goes. But he made some great things. His Super 8 movies, the movies that he made when he was a kind of gay hippie, are just the best, actually. They're really great. These people kind of dressing up and taking their clothes off and shining mirrors at the cameras and this stuff. When it's really a little bit more playful, for me it was better than kind of the position that he would take. Because he was absolutely vilified by the British culture industry also, you know. So he was in a corner, and that must have been a horrible place to be. You know, I mean, really tabloid newspaper shock, horror, scandal stuff. And this is way before the whole kind of disgusting YBA, young British artist thing was happening. Derek was really a kind of maverick at a certain time when there weren't structures of acceptance about that kind of... that looseness, that honesty, actually.
Okay. Maybe now the last minutes, it would be great if Molly, after this kind of effort of these 3 days or maybe 4 days, Utopia Station here in Frankfurt, could you say what are the results for you, maybe as a curator, because we had now some different perspectives on what the Utopia Station can be, in the way as Daniel Birnbaum says yes to everything, maybe, or in the way the conversation matters and so on. And what is your interest in the Utopia notion?
Well, I wouldn't exactly call myself a curator. I think by now it's interesting because technically we are defined as curators, Hans Ulrich Obrist, Rick Tiravanija, and me. But I think we're more organizers, you know, like the grassroots organizer is an organizer. And we try to create a structure or an occasion for people to meet each other, bring something to the occasion or the station, which is what we call these things. Rick Reet would say we bring something and take something away. And that kind of exchange becomes very interesting, whether it happens, you know, in words and images in a more transient way, such as we just had at the Tot, or whether it happens, you know, in a sustained space, as it did in Venice, as it will in Naples, and so on and so on. It's a kind of experiment in a complex exchange, which I think everybody finds, who gets deeply involved in it anyways, and who actually exchanges there, as opposed to just goes and looks on, you know. People find it very interesting because the exchanges are very surprising. And so, for instance, we just finished our 2 days at the Tot with a kind of exchange, a kind of collaboration, a kind of duet by Thomas Barley and Thomas Saraceno, in which we ended really with our heads in the clouds, because Thomas showed his airport city project and the balloon launching, and all of a sudden human exchange was taking place off the ground in the space that is on the air side of the airport, a kind of international zone, right, where another world, I guess, is already possible, but we wouldn't call it utopia quite yet. It's sort of an uncharted, undefined zone that kind of falls out of state legal systems into a kind of international airspace, I guess. Eh? And, you know, we came, you know, from documentary, basically, I guess what you would call documentary photographs of the World Social Forum in Mumbai yesterday. That was kind of our point of departure to this, you know, these balloons being launched, a big black balloon being launched in Argentina. And as a trajectory, it was pretty fascinating, but it's hard to summarize such a thing because, you know, there are many, many points on the way. I mean, Kareth was actually dropping the points of others, the points of, well, I guess you should speak to this maybe rather than me, but a little Merleau-Ponty, a little William Burroughs, right, a little more.
And maybe you are suspicious, having a kind of positive humanistic view on utopia, and this would be a question because we have here Erno Frun, who is curator of the Auschwitz trial here in Frankfurt. So we have different, maybe two different positions. This is what I'm interested in. What kind of contrast? Are contrasts interesting in the utopian matters?
Maybe you should explain it a little bit more, because maybe it's too abstract, I suppose.
I could say, though, without even hearing of the contrast, right, or the opposition, that the answer would have to be yes and chess, which is Marcel Duchamp's, you know, sort of famous reply everything.
Sure. Uh-huh.
Because I don't know that in, you know, when we get into the zone of the social project for the arts, if you've got a really open experiment going, which is what I hope the Utopia Station is, that it's very productive to get into the yes and no of it. It's because I think we're at a place right now where it's more important to try to do something with whomever you can find to work with. And that's it's a bit like doing the peace marches. You know, there's a kind of movement there. It's disorderly. It comes from different places. The motives are very mixed. You could call it unified in some ways, but not in all ways. But the important thing really is that there's, you know, something moving, frankly, you know.
Yeah, that's exactly what the exhibition wants to do with the contemporary artists, because you have such a heavy, let's say, historical theme, and you try to bring something in that gives a movement towards something without really knowing to define what this something can be. But there is something happening, like, let's say, a positive or whatever, but a way that goes further than that what is there. So there is a kind of interchange of ideas, creating new platforms, creating maybe a platform for totally other public, because totally other public is coming there and are confronted with art pieces, and they bring this, maybe this kind of people that normally would never come into this art situation or whatever situation of communication, create for them platforms to communicate on something which really has a historical meaning that maybe is very difficult to communicate of for certain people. So I think that's what artists within the show, the artists I selected from different countries with different approaches, with other media, I would like to happen, that the public finds a new way or another way, not even a new way, maybe another way, to communicate about certain kind of items, which I cannot define. It's a definition of the spectator, it's a definition of the ones people who really want to go for something like that. So I think that's important.
Right. Well, everybody has a past, right?
Yes.
And everybody speaks some language already. And the question of communication often involves, you know, some sort of simple things like translation. But I think also when you get into the international airspace, that it's, how should we say, it gets very complicated in terms of understanding things exactly.
Absolutely.
And perhaps the point is not to understand things exactly, and to let there
exactly
be some kind of slippage.
Bravo.
Between the old words and the new words.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would say to all of this is that there's a... I should, I guess, parenthetically say that I am a teacher. And I've realized over the years of teaching that one of the most difficult things to do, actually, is to teach somebody something they don't know already. And to get them to try to grasp the thing they don't quite understand yet. And all knowledge really takes place in that zone where you go to the thing you don't know. And you don't really know why. And this whole business of, you know, trying to stop on the way to utopia and exchange has a lot to do with, you know, looking at the black hole beside you or the black hole inside your head and jumping in.
Absolutely.
It's like, you know, I hate to go here, but I have to. It's like the black balloon being launched in Argentina,
mm-hmm.
all right? It doesn't exactly fly for very long. It kind of doesn't get off the ground, but there's something in it, right? Mm-hmm. Something there.
Yeah, that's really a really good ending, and we have to stop now. Yes, thank you very much for the talk. Goodbye.
Okay, thank you.
So, am Mikrofon verabschiedet sich Felicia Herrschaft. Nächsten Dienstag bzw. nächsten Sonntag, 18 bis 20 Uhr im TAT, ist dann Micha Brumlik im Gespräch. Vielen Dank. Ciao.
Ooh, love you.